That Great Business Show. Winner, highly commended award, Irish Podcast Awards.
Welcome to episode 171 of That Great Business Show, home of great business tips, insights, and opportunities on every episode, delivered in our commute-friendly package. And all thanks to daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website. If you're looking for your first home or looking to upsize or downsize your abode, make sure you visit daft.ie to find that next place you call home. I'm Conall O'Mora and Fáilte Stair. On this episode, as part of our Beachhead USA mini-series, The Ultimate Crib Sheet for Expanding into the US Market, we meet a man who may have double-jobbed while working with Enterprise Ireland while setting up his nascent bar business, and who now co-owns some of New York's finest.
If it's for sale, it's on daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website. Whether you're looking for your first home or planning your next move, make sure you're on daft.ie, the best place to buy or sell in Ireland.
Travel to Connecticut, USA with Aer Lingus service to Bradley International Airport. With the daily flights from Dublin to Hartford, we make business travel to Connecticut easy. Save time with US pre-clearance, enjoy Aer Lingus award-winning flight service, and experience the convenience of Bradley International Airport, perfectly situated for your travel needs. Learn more and plan your next business trip at aerlingus.com.
We love finding a good business story that you won't have heard before. But how about a great business story? And we know you really love those. Beachhead USA is our mini-series that gives real insights on doing business in the USA. The promise is huge and exciting, but it can go horribly wrong, be horribly expensive, and it can end in disappointment for some. We like those stories, warts and all. However, then you hear a story like that of Rory Curtin and his business partners David Mahaly and Mark Gibson. Rory left DCU with his business degree in 1999. He joined Enterprise Ireland immediately, ended up by chance in New York, and whilst there started building a business. And boy, it's some business. Rory Curtin, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you, Conall. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Where do we start? We may as well start with Enterprise Ireland. You come out of college, go into Enterprise Ireland. By complete chance, you are sent to New York.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was complete chance as well that I even went to work for Enterprise Ireland. I was strolling through the library one day. I stumbled across a friend who was filling out an application form. I said, I'll have one of those. Filled it out, sent it in, got called in for interview, went through the process and got offered a position in Enterprise Ireland. I could have been sent anywhere in the world. I think Copenhagen, Paris and New York were the top offers that I got. And I quickly, as a 22-year-old young bucko, I landed on New York.
It must be happily. So exciting. 22, being paid to be in New York.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, I had never had too many dollars rubbed together, but then suddenly there I was, 22, put up in New York, nice little office up in the sky with Enterprise Ireland. And it was a great start for me and my entrepreneurial endeavors over here.
But you've just told me that there was nothing in your background that could have led to what you're now doing. So how did you transition out of Enterprise Ireland and do the big reveal then and tell us what you actually do now?
Yeah, I stayed with Enterprise Ireland for 7 years and then I jumped ship. I mean, the options were to stay with Enterprise Ireland or to jump out, go in a different direction with a different company, or jump out and do something on my own. And I suppose doing something on my own was always what I wanted to do. You know, my dad was an entrepreneur. He had his own business.
That always helps.
It always helps. And, you know, it was encouraged. There are not a lot of parents out there that would encourage people to, you know, leave your good government paying job and jump out and do something on your own.
And what was the family business?
It was a plumbing business, a mechanical engineering business.
In Cork.
You know, he grew to a pretty big scale. And, you know, unfortunately, like every other construction company at the time, it was one of the victims of the Celtic Tiger in the end. But it certainly afforded him to give us a great life, a great education, and get us, you know, I'm one of five kids. So he raised us all and we've all done pretty okay.
And now the big reveal, because I want to see, because I've been told this story. Of course, I've been told this story. How did you end up doing what you're doing? So what do you and your two partners do?
Sure. So we own a hospitality group, a small hospitality group.
Small?
Well, you know, we're 300 employees strong now. We have 8 locations and we serve, what, well over a million customers every year. But we're a bar group.
And it's got a curious name.
Sleeping Giant.
Why is it called the Sleeping Giant?
We don't know. You know, I think a lot of it relates to the and Fire Marv down in close to Dingle.
I love it.
Yeah, I spent a lot of my youth there.
Off Ballyferry.
Mark's parents lived down there. You know, so that really was it. You know, we like the idea of the Sleeping Giant. Quiet underdogs.
Okay, now underdogs. One bar is good. Two is very good. 3, 4, 5. 6, 7, 8. That's a lot.
It's a lot of work.
When you were with Enterprise Ireland, now tell the truth. We only want the truth.
Sure.
Did you have 2 jobs?
Maybe at the tail end I did, but certainly not for the first, you know, say 6 years. I think I opened Boo probably in the last year while I was with Enterprise Ireland. And, you know, I certainly had that in my horizon. I was also, you know, admittedly, I had the visa handcuffs. I had my visa through Enterprise Ireland, and I had to segue my way out of that and get my visa as I left there. But to answer your question, yeah, I suppose at this point I can admit that I was putting a little effort behind the bar while also working, during the day at Enterprise Ireland.
Well, when I was asking about you, I am told that you put in hours beyond belief, that you did do your day job, I'm sure, very diligently. And then you went and did the night job very diligently, which probably meant that you worked all day and all night.
Well, welcome to hospitality. That's what we do. We never close.
Well, this is when you were working with Enterprise Ireland that you put on the pinny or the apron or whatever and went across the road to the bar. Was that it?
It was something like that.
Well, do give me some detail because I love those stories.
Sure. So just about working with Enterprise Ireland?
I know the transition. I'm still trying to get you to actually admit more about this because...
Okay.
Did you know that Enterprise Ireland listens to this podcast?
So I better watch my P's and Q's.
No.
Let me
for some money back.
Yeah, let me start by saying Enterprise Ireland was a phenomenal start for me. You know, I always knew from a very young age that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I started my first little business when I was 10 years old.
Every
year my parents used to throw the 5 kids in the back of the car, hook on a caravan, and we went to France every year on our holidays, we went camping. And while there, I discovered, you know, firecrackers, fireworks, which I had a great time.
Importing explosives.
Wait for it. I sure was. And, you know, I brought them home the first year and I quickly realized that all my friends were fascinated with the things. So next year, I loaded up the caravan, smuggled them in through customs. They were literally hidden underneath the cushions in the back of the caravan. But I was able to buy a singular, what we call a banger, for 1 penny. 1 penny in France. And I went in and I sold it in the schoolyard for 20 pence a piece.
Happy days.
Yeah, so 2,000%. So it gave me a good taste for entrepreneurialism.
So far you've been double jobbing and you have been importing illegal explosives.
Yeah.
That's a good start. Okay.
It's a good start. So yeah, that was my misspent youth. Then I found my way into Enterprise Ireland, and I said it was a really, really great foundation for anybody that, you know, has the entrepreneurial spirit. I arrived in September 1999. I was put into the consumer division, which is, you know, anything from crystal goblets to clothing to, you know, anything you would buy in a store, essentially. And as I arrived, it was, you know, kind of the dot-com era and technology was taking off, and I was a bit upset that I wasn't put into the technology division.
The sexy
division. But no, I was left in the consumer division. But in a way, I think it was serendipitous. While my colleagues that flew over with me, they were working on the sexy new, you know, technology products of the time. Very often they had no idea what they were selling, or they were pigeonholed into doing a very, you know, specific thing for companies or, you know, within Enterprise Ireland. But I arrived into the consumer division, which was downsizing at the time. So they were pulling resources from consumer and pushing them into technology, which meant I had to take on a lot more responsibility than what I probably was qualified to do, paid to do, certainly. And it put me in a position where I was, you know, dealing directly with some, you know, amazing businessmen and businesswomen from Ireland who were selling their products over here. And I had to roll up my sleeves and help them figure out a way to sell them over here in the US. And what was great about consumer at the time is that the products were tangible. You know, a glass is a glass, a sweater is a sweater. We know exactly what it is. It wasn't some obscure piece of software. I knew exactly what I was selling, and I had to figure out how to help the companies get there and get that product out to market. So it was a really good grounding. Really enjoyed it. I feel enormously fortunate to have worked there for the 7 years that I did.
So you're sitting there, presumably with your two pals, in a bar. And where did the idea of opening a bar come from?
Sure. Well, I mean, I was always looking for ideas. Everywhere I looked, I saw an opportunity. I saw an idea. I'm an ideas guy. And part of my misspent youth was spent in pubs, I suppose, like all of ours. So as a young Irish guy in New York, 22, 23 years of age, myself and my friends, we hit the bars at the weekends and sometimes during the week as well, maybe a bit too frequently. But when we were there back in 99, 2000, 2001, things felt a little stale. Not stale. We had fun. We had a great time. But things felt a bit kind of cookie cutter. Certainly the Irish bar world was enormously successful. But at the time, you know, I kind of stood back and I looked and I said, I know that this can be done better. You know, I was looking for that better mousetrap. So I had ideas and had notions in my head and what could be done and how we would do it. And then the big question, of course, is where's the money going to come from and who am I going to do it with?
And complete that sentence.
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, we're very lucky as business partners. We found each other. Dave Mahaly, I went to middle and college with and secondary. So I know him since I'm 12 years old. He was one of my best friends, still is. And then Mark Gibson, I went to DCU with, really great guy, great friend also. And just by luck, we all ended up in New York through different routes. And as I said, I was always looking for the right people to do it with. And as soon as I sat down with the two guys, as soon as we sat around the table, which was at Enterprise Ireland, actually, after hours, we just knew everything made sense. And we put a quick plan together. We divided up the responsibilities and we said, okay, let's go for this.
And why bars? I mean, it's a big city. Could have been anything. You could have been making zippers.
Yeah, well, again, it was what I knew. And it was something that I spotted an opportunity in. And we just put the heads down and went for it. It was simple as that.
But you had to say bar. You had to say the word bar. Mm-hmm. And your two other pals had to say, yes, bar. And then you said, what do we know about a bar?
Very little.
Besides being on the other side of the bar, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what, Connell, I think a good part of our story and why we've done so well is that we knew nothing. We knew very little. I'd never lifted a glass. Neither had Dave. You know, Mark had pulled a few pints and collected glasses back in Dublin in his youth. So we were kind of coming, we weren't predisposed to ideas and concepts that worked for others. So we came into the business with a fresh set of eyes, an open mind, ideas as to what we think might work. And we really, you know, our first location, we just built a bar that we would want to hang out in ourselves.
And when you say you built it, there were three, you were all in your late 20s at this stage,
Yeah,
you?
We're 26, okay. 27.
Which is quite young.
It's quite young, yeah. Okay.
So you sit around and then you see, like, it's a huge city. Mm. How did you choose your first location?
Every weekend, we got up, we went out and about, we walked the city, we were looking for locations, we got out, we spoke to people. The Irish,
say you walked, did you walk?
We physically got out and we walked around the neighborhoods. We, you know, at the time, I think it was Craigslist where we saw the ad for the bar that was for sale that we
found. But those who don't know what Craigslist is, it's like a daft.ie for the US.
That is exactly right, yeah. Which is, it's still used today, but not to the same degree that it was back then. Anything you wanted to buy or sell was on Craigslist. But yeah, we physically went out every Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, walking the streets looking for locations. Because when we sat down that day around the table, we said, okay, we're going to give ourselves 12 months to open our first bar, to find our first bar, and 18 months to open it. And we said we'd have 5 bars within 10 years. That was our plan. And we said, okay, this is what we got to do. These are the people we need to speak to. And this is approximately how much money we need. Let's go and do this. So it was action. We didn't sit around talking. We got out. We met people. We met pub owners over here in New York that were very generous with their time. You know, they explained to us what worked, what didn't work. And we went looking at locations. And we must have looked at, you know, 20 or 30 spots over the course of 2 to 3 months when we stumbled across a little ad in Craigslist. And it was a little place called Noah's down in St. Mark's Place, which is If you're not familiar, it's a very vibrant, amazing little street in New York. I would argue that it's the coolest street in New York. But we went down there.
Oh, you have there. A business there.
We have a business there now, yeah. But that was that little place called Noah's, which was a little tiki bar, is the bar that we bought. And we quickly flipped it and turned it into Bua, B-U-A, the Irish word for victory. And it's been standing there victorious now for 19 years. It'll be open 20 years next September.
Wow. That is some story, but that's only the beginning. So Bua is winning for you. Now, it's not plain sailing. Let me ask you one question. I asked this of John Fitzpatrick of Fitzpatrick's Hotel a long time ago. Doing business in New York, when I hear bars, or in his case, hotels, people that you don't want sometimes call around and ask questions or say that they would like to help you, but they might need some money to help you. Have you had any of those kinds of... He admitted that he did have those kinds of incidents. It's actually very interesting. He just stood up to them. Brave man. I live in the New York of the movies.
Mm.
Is doing business in your trade in New York is...
Well,
you hear what I'm trying to ask you very gently.
I hear... I hear you loud and clear. And it's a very good question. And it was one of those questions that we had very early on for the guys that were already in the business way back in, it was 2004 when we got into it. And we were nervous. We didn't know what to expect. And
we had been very nervous.
Yeah, we'd seen the movies. We'd heard the stories. We had our concerns. But no, I mean, the answer is, and maybe it was just at the time that we arrived into it, that the city was cleaned up and nobody was calling around, shaking us down for money. Now, you know, there's a different part of this, which is New York City and taxes and fees for this and fines for that.
We'll get on to that in the second part of this interview, but stick now with it. So okay. No shakedowns,
but we were warned that, you know, back at the time, everybody had a jukebox, or most people had a jukebox. And we were told, if you get a jukebox, you will have somebody visit you and you will be kindly recommended to replace your jukebox with one of theirs, and you will share the proceeds.
And you didn't get a jukebox.
No, it was just in time. Thank you, Apple, when the iPods were coming out. So yeah, that's what we went for.
So hop on from Bua to, what was your next one?
Wilfie and Elle, named after my grandparents in the West Village.
I love it. And how long after Bua did that open?
I think that was about 4 to 5 years afterwards.
Oh, so there was a long
there was a long gap, yeah. And, you know, we had to build the finances to open our second one. You know, Bua was a heavy lift. If you want to hear how we got the money, I think it's an interesting story. Yeah,
everybody wants to know how.
Okay, well, you know, it was back at the tail end of the Celtic Tiger. That infamous day when we sat around the table and shared our responsibilities, we said, okay, let's split this three ways. You all have money shared, you got to make your money, and then you're going to have to find your money from somewhere else. So I went up and down Park Avenue. I worked on Park Avenue and I took a day off work, walked up and down the avenue, visited like 5 or 6 or 7 different banks, innocently had a suit and tie on me, trying to borrow money to open a bar down in St. Mark's Place.
Just a reminder, you're still 26.
I'm still 26. Yeah. And, you know, needless to say, you know, given the stats, and you know, the stats are 60% of bar or restaurant businesses go out of business after a year. 80% of them are out of business after 5 years. So when you're going in armed with those statistics, and they know the statistics in the banks, I was laughed out of the place. We leave it at that. But then we found Bua. We had money to find and raise. So we were adamant that we didn't want to bring on any partners outside of just ourselves. So I took a shot. I flew back to Ireland and I went into my local bank and I said, here's the deal. I need to borrow money. At the time, it wasn't a huge amount of money at the time, but it was everything to me back then. And I went into to the bank in Cove in Cork. And
give them a shout out. If they were good to you, give them a shout out.
They were great. The AIB in Cove, County Cork. I will give them a huge credit and a huge shout out for helping me start my journey. But I went in and they took a shot. They're like, okay, let me get this straight. You want money to open a bar in New York? I said, yes. And they said, okay. Off you go. Come back in the morning. We'll have the check and the paperwork ready. My jaw nearly hit the floor.
How mad is that?
It was bananas. It was absolutely nuts. But you know what? We got the money. I quickly sent word back to New York. Dave and Mark were on planes promptly after me to come and do the same thing. We all got our share of the money that was required to get the capital together to get BUA off the ground. And we pay back our loans in full. But that was how we got the capital to get going, because it's enormously capital intensive at the start, you know, to get a place open.
Round figures, kind of hundreds of thousands, half a million.
How long is a string, you know?
Yeah, but just to give an idea, I mean,
you'd be hard pressed to get anything together for less than $500,000. Nowadays,
yeah.
But I mean, you could spend up to $10 million to.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should have explained to anybody who of a younger generation, a check is a piece of paper that you write an amount of money on, and people give you money for it. It's amazing. It's unfortunate.
They still make them.
Well, very rare now, I can tell you. I'm going to hold you there, Rory Curtin, because we have to take a quick break. But after that, we'll get into doing business in New York.
That great business show.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin. No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. De Facto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
Are you buying or selling a home? If it's for sale, it's on daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website.
Travel to Connecticut, USA with Aer Lingus service to Bradley International Airport. With daily flights from Dublin to Hartford, we make business travel to Connecticut easy. Save time with US pre-clearance, enjoy Aer Lingus award-winning flight service, and experience the convenience of Bradley International Airport, perfectly situated for your travel needs. Learn more and plan your next business trip at aerlingus.com.
That great business show. Winner, highly commended award. Irish Podcast Awards.
And I am here with Rory Curtin, and we're discussing doing business in New York, particularly in hospitality, because Rory, starting with one outlet, now has built up to 8 outlets. And it's not that straightforward. Rory, explain how to build an empire.
How to build an empire? Well, the first thing I'd say, you need to be entrepreneurial in spirit. This isn't just a job. You have to treat this as a business. And I think the common mistake that a lot of restaurateurs and publicans and, you know, hospitality folk out there make is that they come into this looking at it as a project. So you got to always have the bottom line.
A project rather than
running a business. You know, it's not a lifestyle business. It's a business.
This is grind. You know,
it's not a project. It's not a hobby. Running a bar is a grind. It's hard work. It's 24/7. Every day of the year, we close 2 days a year, Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's it. Otherwise, we're open. We're open. You know, there's people working for us 24/7. Middle of the night, they're scrubbing floors, prepping kitchens, prepping food. You know, we roll into the morning, we open up, we do our lunch service into dinner, into the evening, late night, and it keeps going. The wheels keep on going. And if your eye isn't on the ball 24/7, you're not going to last very long.
Mistakes. You've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. But tell me about mistakes that you might have made.
Sure. You know, I think we're fortunate enough to not have made too many mistakes.
I'm glad I was saying.
Yeah, so. we're 8 for 8. We've defied the odds in terms of the statistics of hospitality business. This is lasting more than 5 years. All of ours are still intact. Yeah, we made plenty of mistakes along the way. I mean, when we opened first, ignorance was bliss. We were breaking a lot of laws, a lot of rules, simply because we didn't know what we were doing. So what I would say, you got to get the professionals on your side. People that do know what they're doing. You know, there was a point we probably tried to take on more than what we could chew without bringing in external help.
What kind of help are you thinking of there or talking of there?
I guess we're talking just about growth, and growing in hospitality is very, very difficult. It's a detail-oriented business where you just got to watch every detail all the time.
So what kind of people would have been ideal advisors for you?
Well, you know, internally in hospitality, we were wise enough early on to hire people that were probably better and certainly more knowledgeable and more experienced than ourselves.
Always helps.
Always helps, yeah. So getting the right people on board, people is everything in our business. If you don't have the right people, you're not at the races. You really aren't. So I would say trying to bite off too much, more than what we could chew, trying to do too much on our own instead of reaching out for help a little earlier. And as soon as we did, it certainly made our lives easier and better, and it helped push us forward.
And the mistakes, just 2-3 mistakes which you might have made so that somebody listening will say, oh, we'll avoid that. Hiring wrong people?
Yeah.
Hiring the wrong advisors? I don't know.
Yeah, hiring the wrong people is definitely a thing.
When you've got millions and millions of people to choose from here, what do you use to select the right people
to hire? That's a good question. And I think from early on, it's one of those kind of principles that we had or ideas that we had that really helped get us to where we are. We never really sat down and looked for people that had the deepest resume or, you know, the best knowledge or, you know, to make the best cocktail. We always sat down and tried to get them to open up and learn who they are first and foremost as a person.
Do you know that I had a lady called Laura Lee from Molson Coors on the podcast? They've given up on CVs. They only want to know what the person is like, not whether they got degrees in this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, change. Well, I would agree with that. I mean, I would hire the right personality over the best resume any day of the week. I always tell my managers that now do the hiring. I said, look, we can train anybody to be a bartender or to be a manager for that matter, but we can't train personality. And that's what we got to go after. And in hospitality, our staff using their personalities to bring people in day after day after day and really be hospitable and warm and kind and caring about the guest. That's what makes a bar or a restaurant successful.
You were at number 2 bar. What happened next? Number 3, 4,
number,
five, six,
yeah, seven. number 3, we took the bridge over to Queens. I had lived in Astoria for many, many years. I lived, I think, total there for 11 years. I'm in a different neighborhood now. But at the time, there just was nothing there. It was, there was a very young, good demographic of people. But there were, you know, there were dive bars and kind of really old school sawdust on the floor, Irish bars around the place. But there was no really good watering hole to cater to the young demographic of people.
And you are talking young of any background, as in you didn't actually go after the Irish.
No. And that's something that we were very keen on. You know, we want our staff and our customers to be diverse. We weren't just chasing that, you know, the green dollar, let's call it the Irish dollar, that wasn't us. And even when we choose our names, you know, the one there's, it's Sweet Afton.
I love
that. It's a great name. You know, the Penrose.
Again, for those of a certain age, as in younger people, Sweet Afton is or was a brand of cigarette.
Yeah, it was an old Irish tobacco.
With a yellow pack.
Correct, yeah. And the location.
Rough, if I remember. I never smoked. But it was rough.
According to my mother, they killed my grandfather. So that's what she had to say when I told her the name. But we always try and have some kind of a link. So Sweet Afton, the building that it's in, was originally a tobacco store way back at the turn of the century. So our landlord told us this and we said, okay, we got to find a connection. So the idea always is to be inclusive. So we wanted it to be subtly Irish. So when you hear the name Sweet Afton, you don't think anything Irish about it. But
Unless you're Irish. Of a certain age.
Well, you know. So that's really what we try and do. Subtly Irish.
Tell me some of the things that people should not do, because there will be 26. 27, in the exact same position as you, young Irish coming over here and want to do the same. What should they not do?
What should they not do? Okay, well, number one, don't go into this business thinking that it's a hobby. It is not.
I thought you were going to say don't go into business because I'll bust you out of it.
No, it's certainly not a hobby. You got to roll up your sleeves. You got to give it everything. You know, when we started off, we were working 18-hour days every day of the week.
And I heard this about you. You actually were working those hours. And when you were with Enterprise Ireland, you were working 24 hours a day.
Every day.
He's trying to make me say, don't say that, but it's true, isn't it?
No, I was never afraid of hard work.
But honestly, how hard? How many hours, how many days a week were you working at the very, very early stages?
At the very early, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you at the worst stage. At the worst stage, it was probably a turning point for us when we opened the Penrose in the Upper East Side. It was that point, the largest space that we had taken on. It was 2,300 square feet of usable square footage.
Which means nothing to me as a customer. Is that big, small?
That's a big bar. Okay. That's a big bar. So we took that on. We opened up. We had never hired different layers of management. Up until that point, we had, I think, three locations. And we were the managers, and there were bartenders underneath us, servers, and, you know, your porters and your barbacks and everything else. When we opened the Penrose, we went into it with the same mindset. I was the GM. I was the AGM. I was the host. I was everything. And it was lunacy. So at that point, you know, for the first probably 3 months after we opened the Penrose, I was the first guy in the door every morning, probably at 8 a.m. And I was the last person out the door at 4 o'clock in the morning.
I had heard that, and I believe it's absolutely true.
It's true, and it nearly killed me. It was hard, but you know, again, I'm very lucky to have very supportive business partners who were, you know, elbow to elbow with me, helping us get through. And we just had to learn, and we had to pivot very, very quickly. You know, the first week we realized, okay, we need to hire hosts. We had no hosts, so we got the hosts in. We quickly hired a manager, then we hired an AGM, and we went from there. But getting it off the ground was brutal. And what's worse, well, it's not that it's worse. It was amazing. We had an explosion of press right at that moment when we opened. It was right in the eye of the construction in the Second Avenue. They were building the subway line up there. So the place was a mess. So this was one of the very first new businesses that had emerged out of the madness.
And had you done that strategically? You're going to say yes now, of course, but
yes and no. The opening of the subway was still way off on the horizon. It was 4 to 5 years out. We couldn't see to the other side of the street for 4 or 5 years until the subway opened. It was just construction everywhere. It was not a pretty sight. So it opened, and it generated a lot of press, and it was very well received. So literally the day we opened, we were packed. We were packed from day one. That doesn't always happen. So it was difficult. It was great because the people came, but it meant that we were just there on our own trying to keep everybody happy. And trust me, we were fighting complaints and angry people every day.
New York does a good complaint, doesn't it?
Oh, they're great. Everybody's a food and bar critic now, and you know, on Yelp and Google and everything else.
But they'll also yell at you as well when it doesn't go right. They don't actually take bad service very well here, do they?
No. You know, to be fair, New Yorkers, they know a good product. They've got a ton of options. You know, if you're not good, they will walk across the street and they'll go somewhere else. The tipping culture is part, I think, to play with it. When they're tipping 20%+ on the top of their check every time they walk into a bar or restaurant, they are entitled to good service. They should get good service. And when they don't get it, they certainly let you know.
COVID hit. What happened during COVID?
Yeah, that was a rough one for us.
I saw his face just dropped there.
Yeah, you know, the bar business is funny in that we're almost recession proof. People are celebrating when they get a job, when they lose a job, when somebody dies, whatever it is, people always go and have a drink.
So long as they can get into the bar.
So long as they can get into the bar, and we usually take them. But we almost felt like we were invincible. We're like, well, I don't think anything can really knock us off our pedestal. We're here. We are at that point. We're 7 bars strong. Everything was flying. We were in a good place. And then, yeah, the black swan, it came.
And did it almost destroy you?
It could have destroyed us. You know, I think only for the support of the government and the PPP program that I don't think there'd be a bar or restaurant left in New York.
Not just yours, any. Yeah,
I don't think there'd be any left. And unfortunately, there were an awful lot of casualties.
So what
through
made
the pandemic.
It different that you were able to ride that problem and others, and I'm well aware of others that did shut, that they weren't able to ride that problem?
Okay, well, I think the hardest decision we ever made and the hardest day we ever had was March 16th. It was the day before St. Patrick's Day. And of course, St. Patrick's Day is a big day for pubs in New York. And everything was happening. The virus was spreading. The media had started. Some of our staff were starting to get sick, and we realized that we were fighting a losing battle here. So we decided, okay, we just got to shut down. The mandate came from the city, in fact. We had to shut down. So within 24 hours, we came from a business of, you know, that point were about 250 employees strong, to having to downsize overnight within 24, 48 hours to, you know, we had a skeleton crew of about six or seven people left, a few in the corporate office and a few on the maintenance side to literally keep the dust off the floor. So that was not pleasant.
And if you're a typical business, you had borrowings to service.
Yes, we're fortunate that we didn't have borrowings to service at that point, but
That's a clever business. We
certainly had our rents to pay.
Yeah.
And you mentioned angry New York customers. They're nothing by comparison to the angry New York landlords. But we had to...
Just give me the... Again, I'm thinking movies. Does this guy come around screaming at you? Hey, where's my rent?
Oh, yeah. We got a couple of mafiosa-style landlords that we had to face and try and hardball during the pandemic.
Which is fine and dandy if you're used to that kind of stuff, but...
Young
lad?
A couple of Irish lads were.
Okay.
We weren't that scared. But no, look, I mean, we had to stop the bleeding very, very quickly. We shut down to very small staff overnight. It was very hard on the staff. A lot of them didn't understand what was happening. You know, they're
nobody
like, what?
Did, yeah.
No,
yeah.
As like, nobody knew what was around the corner. Nobody at that point had really fully comprehended the enormity of the issue that was facing us and the wave of what was coming, you know, not just New York, it was worldwide. So a lot of our staff that had been working for us for 5, 6, 7 years, they were looking at us saying, what, this little nonsense pandemic thing is going to be over next week and you're laying us all off? It was hard for us to do that, but we did it. We had to do it. We had to go and negotiate with all of our vendors. We had invoices that we had to pay. We had to negotiate some of those down. We had to go to every single landlord and try and have them come to the table and meet us somewhere to help us get through the pandemic. Some were very, very generous and some were very, very greedy. And unusually, the smaller the landlord, the more generous they were. The bigger and the more corporate they were, the harder they were.
Interesting.
But we got through.
You're at 8 bars now. Do you call them bars or do you call them venues? Or
we call them bars. We're a bar group.
The future. 16? 32? How many?
Well, look, we've been through an arduous 2 years. We expanded. You know, we took advantage of a couple of vacations next door to us in three of our existing locations.
And by
we
vacations, expanded. You're not talking about holidays. You're talking about empty
empty lots. Yeah. Yeah. So... a couple of spaces opened up and we expanded in next door. We created a little annex bars onto three of our locations. We completely renovated the Wren down in the Bowery. We just opened Albert's, which is a 6,500 square foot location, a block from Grand Central.
Albert's named after?
Albert's is named after Albert's Quay in Cork.
Okay.
So the Penrose is named after
Reynolds.
Now, the Penrose is named after Albert's Quay, and that was a little nod to the Second Avenue construction that I was speaking about earlier. Right across the River Lee at the other side is Albert's Quay. So we were going for a 1950s Midtown New York iconic kind of a vibe there. And we just thought Albert's felt friendly. It had that little small Irish link back to the homeland, and that's the name we went with.
You're still going to tell me that you're going to double, treble, quadruple?
No, well, I was just about to say that we're still just at the very tail end of all these construction projects. There's been 5 construction projects in 2 years. The capital outlay to that was enormous. So I've got to try and fill my bank balance up and bring my family on vacation somewhere sometime soon. So there's that. But also, you know, I revert back to the fact that you have got to nurture and water your flowers. You've got to keep an eye on them. We're going to take a break for a while, for a number of years, I think, and just refocus on the 8 locations that we have. Some of them are flying. Some of them, they need some work. And that's what you need to do in hospitality. I think people can sometimes, through growth, they can lose sight of what's important, which is your bread and butter. So for the coming years, we're going to rebuild, we're going to regroup, we're going to make our existing bars stronger, we're going to, you know, tighten up our staff, we're going to rejuvenate, reinvent ourselves, we've got to reimagine ourselves all the time, and maybe down the line there might be 1 or 2 bars left in us, but look, this is a younger man's game. It's not for the faint of heart.
As a young man.
Well, young enough. But I've got 2 little kids now, 2 and 4. So that has taken a couple of years off me. But, you know, I don't think we have ambitions to get to 20, 30, 40 bars. That's not us. We enjoy what we do. We are we're a group of neighborhood bars. We want to make sure that we continue to cater to our audience and our customers on a day-to-day basis. And if we go chasing dreams of having bars in Vegas and California and Chicago and wherever else, we're going to lose the ones that have been very, very good to us. So I think we'll be happy. We might hit 10, you know, okay, maybe 5, 6, 7 years down the line. But I'm not sure we go beyond that.
Final question we ask all of our guests. Who would Rory Curtin hire in a heartbeat?
Who would I hire in a heartbeat? Well, you know, reverting back to what I said about hiring people, our first question when we started opening Bua, the question we had is, you know, would we want to sit down and have a drink with this guy or girl that we're interviewing? That was our rule of thumb. So really what you're asking me is who I'd like to go and have a cocktail with.
Okay.
I suppose it would probably, not to get too political, but I'd love to sit down and have a beer with Barack Obama.
Who wouldn't?
But he would. He's got to be.
I can think of one guy. Maybe.
He's got to be top of the list. He's got to be top of the list.
Did you ever meet him?
No.
Okay.
No. I hope to one day.
We'll tag him on this and we'll say that you'd like if he dropped in. There'll be a pint of black stuff behind the bar.
Barack, if you're listening, I'll give you a job too. If you want to put on the apron and serve a few pints and make a few cocktails. But another, just if I can give a secondary answer to that question and you know, I suppose more on the business acumen side.
More likely is what you're
saying. More likely, but highly unlikely because he just retired. But I'm a huge fan of Howard Schultz.
Okay.
from Starbucks. I think what he has done and accomplished is incredible. He's just revolutionized an entire industry, it being coffee, of course. But what I do find fascinating about him is having the understanding of how difficult it is to run 8 bars, you know, not to mention just one, but running 8 bars, the difficulty of keeping quality and standard and keeping your staff smiling every day when your customers walk through the door is enormous. He's got, I think it's 400,000 staff and about 32,000-33,000 store locations worldwide. How they do that is incredible. But what I also like about the guy, and a lot of people have, you know, I share this with a lot of people and people kind of look down their noses at me and say, well, you know, he's a corporate animal, but he's not. He founded the business because he wanted to create a company that his father never had the opportunity to work for. He came from very humble beginnings in Brooklyn. His father was in and out of jobs, no health insurance, no nothing. So he wanted to create that company. He's got an empire of a business in an industry that treats their employees, you know, on a large commercial scale, and I'm not going to name any names, but you know, those big commercial restaurant fast food chains that are out there, if they all treated their employees the same way Starbucks treated theirs, I think we'd have a much better world.
Sounds to me like Rory Curtin has big ambitions that he's not telling us about at the moment. Rory Curtin, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Connell.
If it's for sale, it's on daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website. Whether you're looking for your first home or planning your next move, make sure you're on daft.ie, the best place to buy or sell in Ireland.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin. No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. De Facto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
It's all go le Chrissy Gno on thatgreatbusinessshow.com.
That Great Business Show.
And that's it from That Great Business Show, episode 171. Great business insights and inspiration, all thanks to our lovely sponsor, daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website. If you're looking for your first home, or maybe you're looking to upsize or downsize, do make sure to visit daft.ie to find that next place you call home. Also, sign up for our email updates and we will send you your own personal copy of the podcast at thatgreatbusinessshow.com. Do share, do like, and do give us 5-star reviews. It really all helps. Advertise with us at That Great Business Show to engage with our incredible audience of entrepreneurs, business owners, and investors. We record at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, where today's studio engineer is the lovely Lee Brennan. Later, the dynamic duo of studio manager Peter Rice and post-production engineer Neil Horner ensure we remain the world's best-sounding business podcast. So for me, Conal Moran, wishes to you all a slán tamall.